It is 8 a.m. in lovely Juneau, and there is a reason that we're in a rainforest. We have a lush, beautiful greenery around us and high clouds this afternoon, or this morning. We're in the state capitol, room 124, Juneau, Alaska, and with me this morning is Representative Woody Salmon, Representative Nancy Dahlstrom, Representative Mark Newman, co-chair Gabriel Ledoux, and myself, Representative Fairclough. This morning, we have scheduled to hear HB 4002 and 4003 administrative presentations and then have a review by committee members. If there's anyone in the audience with a cell phone or a BlackBerry, if you would power those down into an off position, silent is actually helpful, but the mics still pick up static, and so it's hard for those at home who are listening from other parts of the state to hear if we keep those on. With that, is there any comments from committee members before we have the administration's presentation? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe if the administration or somebody from revenue can tell us a little bit about a long-range plan for Alaska. My concern with the $1,200 in the outlay of that money right now is the fact that I feel probably in 4 or 5 years we're going to be in a deficit. And are we going to have to come right back and charge an income tax or take people's permanent fund dividends check back then so that we can give away the money now? And so in your presentation, if you could speak to a little bit 4 or 5 years down the road, what you think is going to happen, how long it maybe will be before you see a deficit coming, talk to that a little bit, because I'm very uncomfortable about having to put out cash money right now and go back and charge an income tax and take people's permanent fund dividend away in 4 or 5 years from now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Newman. Also, I have passed out a legal opinion that Representative Coghill got for us after I posed two questions about the eligibility requirements and the constitutionality of preserving the permanent fund, and those have been distributed to committee members, and we'll have the administration to speak to those this morning. Please join us. Your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair Fairclough, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today. For the record, my name is Randy Ruaro, R-U-A-R-O. I am a special assistant to the governor. Madam Chair, HB 4002 is a very important bill for Alaskans. The bill would share a $1,200 per person payment with them. Alaskans are the collective owners of the state's resource wealth under our Constitution. The payment would be made on a one-time special payment basis. The specific question through the chair that Representative Newman posed, I'm going to let Deputy Commissioner Burnett answer. But on the issue of whether we can afford it, and does it make sense, we can't afford this special one-time payment. Oil prices have more than doubled from $70 a barrel in July of 07 to record levels of $145 a barrel at the start of business today. The $1,200 payment per person would represent a fraction of the state's expected surplus revenue for FY09. Not surprisingly, though, when oil prices are high, it also means Alaskans are hurting with high prices for many consumer products. So the timing of the payment is particularly helpful to Alaskans. The administration is also prepared to make the payment quickly if the legislature approves this bill. Our Division of Finance believes we can issue the checks to the first of the two groups of Alaskans that are eligible, the Alaskans that have been found by the PFD division to be qualified for an 08 permanent fund. That's, I think, roughly 620,000 Alaskans. Of course, those Alaskans are spread out all over the entire state. No region, no income group, no Alaskan resident is left behind in this bill. Another important part of the bill, Madam Chair, is that there are a number of federal laws that affect Alaskans receiving federal benefits. Some examples are the food stamp program, adult public assistance, VA benefits, We've taken steps in the bill, Madam Chair, to hold those Alaskans harmless in the sense that they will receive the benefit of this payment. Our hold harmless provisions are a little broader than what's present in the permanent fund statutes. We've extended them to disabled veterans and veterans over 65 receiving a pension. Those are important provisions, Madam Chair. In a nutshell, that is the bill, and I can walk through the sections with Mr. Burnett or take questions.
Two things. First, I'd like to recognize several people who've joined us in the audience. Minority Leader Beth Kurtula is with us this morning, Representative Bryce Edgman, and Representative Andrea Dahl. We thank you for joining us this morning. We can have a sectional analysis, or we do have questions that are beginning to form. Which way would you like to handle it?
Perhaps it'd be good to walk through the sections and then go to questions, if that's...
That would be helpful.
Great.
And right now we're speaking to 4002, and then the administration will present on the second bill. Randy, is that the intention?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, for the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Revenue. Section 1 of the bill sets out the actual Alaska Resource Rebate Program, sets out the amount of $1,200, gives the opportunity for people to elect not to receive a payment under the program, and then sets it up in the Department of Revenue. Has two classes of people that are qualified for it, people who receive a permanent fund dividend for 2008, and people who are residents as of April 1st, 2008, and are continual resident until an application period in October through November, from October 1 through November 30th of 2008. So that's a six-month residency requirement. And those people have to provide proof of identity, proof of residency, and and have two people verify that they were in the state at that time. So that provides us with some certainty that they're in fact who they are, that they're actually here, and that there are people that will attest to that. And it provides in that section all of the potential ways that a person can verify their residency and their identity. Provides for how a parent or guardian provides for identification of their children and that they are in fact the parent or legal guardian. And then it provides in that same section the hold harmless provisions that Randy Ruaro has already spoken to. And then Section 2 repeals the bill in June 30th, 2009. So it's just a one-time temporary, and it's an immediate effective date. And if I could speak to how we would intend to operate this program should it pass, the Department of Revenue takes applications for permanent fund dividends during the period January through March each year. And we had about 643,000 applications come in. Of those, by this time, we've determined that approximately 580,000 of them are eligible, and we're still receiving additional information from others. If this bill were to pass now, sometime in August, we would then take the number of the people who we'd already determined eligible. So I think that would be around 600,000 at that time that we'd already done all the verification on. We would then send a computer to the Division of Finance in the Department of Administration, when we would run checks and send them out to those 600,000 Alaskans in August. Then as we determine final qualifications on the other somewhere between $10,000 and $20,000 Alaskans who will qualify for the permanent fund. And before, in fact, we determine what the amount of the permanent fund dividend is, we would be continuing on a weekly basis or a biweekly basis to send these checks out as soon as people are deemed qualified. Then starting October 1, actually prior to October 1, we will have developed an application form. We would have it on the web. We would have it distributed to offices in health and social services, public assistance offices, to Department of Labor offices, and wherever else we can get it, to libraries, et cetera, so that people had it with instructions and how to get it back to us. And as soon as we started receiving those in the application period in October, we would begin verifying and sending checks out as they're received. So it'll probably be on a weekly basis. We think there's somewhere between 35 and 50,000 people who would be, and I think our fiscal note speaks to the numbers of expected people that would qualify under the six-month provision who did not qualify for the permanent fund dividend.
Thank you. I do have people in line for questions. Is there any further comments that the administration would like to give before we start into questions?
No.
Thank you. Representative Ledoux.
I've got a couple of questions. First of all, can you repeat how many people would be eligible who didn't qualify for the permanent fund dividend?
Well, I think in my fiscal note, I've estimated 45,000 for the purposes of the fiscal note.
Not all.
Thank you.
What's the rationale of providing it to folks who don't qualify for the permanent fund dividend?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think we could have Randy add to this, but there are a number of people who do not apply for the permanent fund dividend, and there are a number of people who live in Alaska who do not receive the permanent fund dividend because they're not residents under the permanent fund dividend qualification. And there are a number of other people who have moved to Alaska and who will have lived here through the summer, will live here through the winter, and would legitimately qualify for this program as we've envisioned it.
Follow up, Representative Ledoux.
So without that second category, would somebody who lives in Alaska and qualifies for the permanent fund dividend, but for some one reason or another has just decided not to apply for that, without that second category, would not that person be eligible?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that person would not be eligible because they would not have applied for the permanent fund dividend and they would not be on the list of eligible Alaskans. And one of the qualifications for an Alaska permanent fund dividend is that you make application during the application period.
Thank you. I've got a few more questions, but I'll let somebody else.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. We'll rotate. For the record, we were joined some time ago by a member of this committee, Representative Cisna. Thank you. And in addition to that, we've been joined by Representative Wilson. Welcome. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have a system set up for payment to relinquish payments for lack of child support? There's traffic fines that are due to communities. There's a number of citizens of this state who owe the state for one reason or another. My concern, more or less, I think, would probably be for lack of child support payments, and for the state to be given that money to them when they're actually owing the state seems to be an issue. Do you have something set up like that, or have you thought about that?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, under the permanent fund dividend program, we accept garnishments from all state agencies and from private servers. We do, in fact, deal with that issue. The way this bill is structured, it does not allow for garnishments of the checks by the state. It would, in fact, go to the person, the child support agency, and actually, it's under my administrative authority in the Department of Revenue, and so I'm quite familiar with it. And what we would intend to do with the Child Support Agency is, if there were people who we sent a check to, and it was one with a large amount, they would, of course, be looking at these people's checking accounts, bank, you know, and they do it. But in order to do this in an expeditious manner, it's next to impossible to deal with all the garnishments, especially private garnishments, in a short period of time. The other thing is, you know, the IRS probably will not garnish this check. Well, they do garnish PFD checks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to work on that one, chew on that one a little bit, because I think we maybe have something that we can work on there.
Representative Newman, could I follow up on that one?
Sure.
To the administration, if we use the permanent fund distribution list in October, would that make all of that a possibility? One of my questions was going to be why we're using a duplication of a process that costs over $500,000. So under your fiscal note, it's $520,000 just for us to administer and write the checks for this. And so if there was a 30-day hold or some way to expedite the permanent fund distribution, if the money was moved through that channel, then is Representative Newman's question answered in a different manner?
To the chair, Representative Faircloth, it would be technically feasible to do it if we did it under those terms. So yes, the answer is we could do it that way.
It sounds like there's hesitation. And as a Representative Samuel sometimes tells us, this isn't a gotcha question. this is can we save $500,000? And I understand that there is an urgency in what we're trying to do to get that done. So is there some hurdle that you're uncomfortable talking about here, or something that you can give me some kind of reasoning why a 30 to 60 day window of a venue that will save us $500,000 we're not using?
Through the chair, I think it's a combination of both partly a legal question and then the administrative ability of the permanent fund to make adjustments and still get payments out on time. That issue I'll defer to Jerry, but there's also the legal and policy question of blending this special one-time payment with an ongoing program that causes some hesitation. The intent is to make it clear to Alaskans that this is on a one-time special basis.
On that point, Representative Ledoux.
I think I've got some real problems with not being able to garnish for child support. What do you think could be done with this bill to correct what I see as a problem there?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it's an issue that we can definitely look at and continue to work on. As Mr. Burnett mentioned, one of the main purposes was to be able to get the payment out quickly to Alaskans. But we can continue to look at and work on your issue.
Representative Ledoux.
If people who are owed child support, for example, had a very limited amount of time to get the names in to the folks who owe them child support, would that help to facilitate that?
To the chair, Representative Ledoux, in terms of child support debt, the Department of Revenue administers both child support and the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. So the Department of Revenue has the information about child support at any time. We don't put it together until we're ready to do the Permanent Fund Dividend distribution, but that's not a real big technical issue. That was a policy issue that was put in the bill that both parties needed this money or would get this money, and that was a policy choice when the bill was drafted. If that's a different policy, then that's something that should be discussed as on a policy basis.
So there really wouldn't be any technical difficulties with doing something with a bill which would allow garnishment in case of child support debt.
To Chair Representative Ledoux, for child support's probably the easiest one in some ways, but private garnishments would be nearly impossible to do in a short period of time, for even if we were going to put this with the permanent fund dividend check, or at the same time as the permanent fund dividend check, because we get the information there in starting in April to do those for the October distribution. So that's a serious technical issue. The child support's a different issue.
Thank you.
Representative Salmon, is your question a follow-up or separate?
Separate.
There's a line for the separate questions. So if I could stay on track. One of the struggles that I'm having as a committee member is the urgency tied with a resource rebate versus the urgency of an energy supplement. And so I could understand that the administration was moving quickly on offering energy rebate when we knew rural Alaska had shipments of fuel that needed to come in by barge. But I have less of a sensitivity to that under a resource rebate that is disallowing us to collect money from people who haven't paid other people and have obligations. So I understand we may have chosen to do that, label it a resource rebate, and develop a program for another reason, and I'll be interested to hear about that. But just so you know, Representative Newman had still other questions, followed by Representative Dahlstrom, and then Representative Salmon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to finalize my concerns on that, I hope the administration comes back with some ability for this committee to look at different things. Where I think you get the gist of where we're going on this one. How about payment for any ability to contest the payments on this if people have not received it? I know that when permanent fund dividend time comes around, every office in this building has their phones ringing about how they didn't get their permanent fund. And Jerry, I know you and I have had this discussion many times. So is there a way for people to contest this if they have not received it but feel they're eligible?
To the Chair, Representative Newman, the legislation specifically sets out a hearing process and has a hearing, the ability to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
There's a formal appeals process that's outlined in the legislation. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here today. Could you speak to any steps the administration has taken or might possibly need to take to address concerns of veterans or senior citizens who might possibly be on programs that are income-based? Would this affect them in any sort of negative way?
Through the Chair, Representative Dahlstrom, we've spent probably upwards of 40 to 50 hours together looking at those issues of hold harmless. We've been in contact with the VA in Washington, D.C., working with them, and we've listed in the bill, actually, the several different veterans programs that we found that were income affected by a payment, and have specifically held them harmless in this bill. And for the seniors, there's two catch-all provisions, actually, in there if they're receiving any type of state benefit, since we can define what affects a state benefit. We've ensured in this bill that they're held harmless as well. So Pioneers Home, people receiving Pioneers Home services, any state administered benefit will be held harmless.
All right, thank you very much for your efforts in protecting that.
Two informational points. One, thank you, Representative Kelly, for joining us this morning. It's about 8:25 for anyone who's keeping track. And second, for committee members, Mike Mitchell from the Department of Law is online if we have questions regarding a legal point that we want clarification for. Next in the line is Representative Salmon, followed by Representative Ledoux.
The question I have is, earlier you brought up the ways they're going to distribute the there's not going to be any mail out, from what I understood, for application?
To the Chair, Representative Salmon, it was not our intent to mail out an application to every Alaskan as we would, you know, at the permanent fund dividend, you mail one to everyone. But in this case, there's a much smaller group of people who will qualify. So our intent was to put it out, you know, through some type of advertising venue, through online, to public offices, et cetera, because it wouldn't you know, it wouldn't make sense to send it to every household in Alaska under the circumstances when you're trying to get a smaller number of people.
Follow-up, Representative Salmon.
In the, well, some of the people that's not in states are eligible for the PFD. Do they qualify for this also?
To the Chair, Representative Salmon, the PFD eligibility in here would be exactly the same as under the PFD. So, yes, there are people who do not live in Alaska who would receive this.
Thank you.
Could, when we originally set a schedule for the bill, I posed two questions, and maybe now, following Representative Salmon's question, we could talk about the eligibility requirements. And I said that it was first blush reading the bill quickly, and we were. I asked whether we were establishing a new residency requirement by the shortened period of time. Could you speak to that?
Sure. Through the chair, to the chair. There are two eligibility pools or sections, I guess. The first one is every person who's qualified for an 08 PFD. That's the largest group by far. It's about, I think, 620,000 Alaskans. Those Alaskans have all been found to be residents through the PFD process. The second pool is the pool of, I think it's estimated between 30 and 40,000 persons who, for whatever reason, are not either applying or not found qualified for a PFD. I've received several phone calls from veterans who don't apply for a PFD but have lived here all their lives because they're not held harmless in the PFD program, so they just don't apply because there's a dollar-for-dollar offset that the VA takes out of their payments back. So it's of no value to them to apply. And so this the second group of persons is made up of folks like that. Is there?
My question was in regards to the 6 months, and inside of the legal opinion that I read in response to my questions, for the record, it was said that Alaska has many different residency requirements for many different types of programs. So if you were applying for an Alaska fishing license, that might be one set of requirements, and if you're applying for the PFD, that's another. So that this program, being unique, has a specific set of residency requirements that would be unique to this program, and that is why the Department of Law, in their response to me, I'm sorry, it was Tam Cook, actually, from Ledge Legal, that responded to say that that's why my concern about the difference in eligibility requirements and whether we were going to see a future challenge on the Alaska residency requirements would not be in place under a resource rebate program that had separate requirements. Is that correct? Am I Mr. Mitchell, have I appropriately outlined the residency requirement issue inside of this language?
Madam Chair, this is Mike Mitchell, Assistant Attorney General. I have not seen Legislative Council's legal opinion, so I really can't comment on it. The way you've described it, it does sound appropriate to me. I would also add that I have not been the lead Assistant Attorney General on 4002. I'm currently here for 4003. So to the extent you have specific legal questions, I'll have to take them and forward them on to the lead Assistant Attorney General on that bill.
Mr. Mitchell, I would like it from our own Department of Law, too. My question was, and I think it's been adequately responded to by Tam Cook, but I would like a concurrent comment from the Department of Law on this issue, and I'm being told that there's someone in the audience here that could answer that, so we'll take you off the hook. Did the administration have another response? Because we have questions, and I'll set mine aside. I just wanted it on the record to follow what Representative Salmon had asked.
Madam Co-Chair, just real quickly, I think it's accurate that the there are many different residency requirements in different programs, and there's a range that the legislature can select from. But Mr. Poe can probably.
That would be fine if he joined us and identified himself for the record. Also, the committee has passed me a note asking who is the lead in the AG's office for this particular bill from the Department of Law.
Good morning. Chris Pogue, Department of Law, Assistant Attorney General. The lead is actually Mike Barnhill, but he's away on a family emergency. and I think he'll be available for follow-up questions on Thursday. I think he's traveling tomorrow.
Thank you.
To try and answer the question, Madam Chair, I think if you look at the PFD program, we always talk about a one-year physical residency requirement. We also know, we're all fondly familiar with the allowable absence provisions, and it says that there's a general allowable absence for each Alaskan that we're allowed to be absent from the state up to 180 days. So we say it's a one-year durational residency requirement, but really all of us are allowed to be gone almost just shy of half a year. So it's really more of a 185-day residency requirement. If you look at this program, it's 180 days. We don't build into this one-time resource rebate program all the allowable absences. That would be complicated, hard to administer. And so this is sort of very akin to the PFD residency requirements. But Tam Cook's opinion is, I agree with, we are talking about a different program. It's an interim program. It's an uncodified law. It has its own purposes, slightly different from the PFD, and it has its own residency requirements, slightly different than the PFD. So, yeah, to the extent that you're concerned with a challenge on this program, we're ready to defend attack on this program as well as the PFD program. They are different programs. As this body's probably familiar, our Alaska Supreme Court is faced a number of these challenges that the Department of Law has defended, and we've gotten very good precedents from the Alaska Supreme Court on the PFD program.
Are there questions for the Department of Law on this issue?
Just a
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on, I believe we're on Representative Salmon's questioning or line of questioning on eligibility. And when I read the bill, I thought I read in there that if you'd already applied for a permanent fund dividend check, that you did not have to reapply for this because you already are in the system on that. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, you're correct. Obviously, as in a one-time program, it's nice to be able to sort of immediately build in applications and eligibility for roughly 600,000 Alaskans and then have to only deal with the sort of overflow or those that didn't apply for whatever reason. So, yes, those folks that are determined to be eligible for the 2008 PFD who, when they apply for it, had to indicate that they had been present in the state during the qualifying year and intended to remain in the state are just, for ease, administrative ease, built into this process and already eligible.
So they do not have to reapply?
They do not have to reapply if they've applied and been found eligible. If they apply and are found non-eligible, then they still have the process and ability to apply for this.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, I've got a question, but it's not for Chris. Do you want to just follow up questions now?
Follow-up questions for the administration or for law?
Not on this particular point. I don't have a question, but I've got a question then for Randy or Jerry.
If you could hold for just a moment, I had one question for the follow-up. You just said that this program is slightly different than the permanent fund as far as how we would defend. And I guess that's where my question was coming from. Under an energy plan, I understood the urgency in the timing and why we were moving quickly to meet that energy need for the state. And so then under the energy need, I was going to have questions on people who qualify out of state and that it's a policy call for the residency requirements and how we would do that. And I appreciate the 6 months and how Representative Liu do define people who currently don't receive the permanent fund but are Alaskans that are living in the state and haven't chosen that for whatever reason. So I see where the administration is going in looking at that group of people that haven't received that. But how is it different? That's where I was going with my second question, which was, are we jeopardizing the permanent fund or providing an argument for someone else in that the permanent fund holds Alaska's resource wealth specifically, and we are distributing Alaska's resource wealth in the same manner. So if it's slightly different, can you help me understand how it's different because it's Alaska's resource wealth? And that's where I was getting stuck. And I don't need to be high-centered on it. We can also have the answer later. But attorneys, as I said last time when we rolled this out, would put me in line, and they have. I've been told by numerous attorneys now that they don't see the issue. But because it's resource wealth, that's why, as a layman, I was tying it together. I understand why legally we may have an arm's length different. But if you could define how it's different than the permanent fund that is happening in October for distribution, and why this resource rebate is different.
I'll attempt to answer your question, Madam Chair. Talking about energy relief, the thing that comes to mind that's probably would be similar is post-Hurricane Katrina, there was a lot of need for disaster relief. And it was not whether you were rich or poor. It didn't matter where you came from. You had a need for that relief. I think energy relief is akin to that. It's a need that the whole state would be experiencing. And because it's more of a needs-based category, it gets a different scrutiny from the Alaska Supreme Court as well as the U.S. Supreme Court. Those needs-based things seem to say that they're more of a basic necessity of life, and they need to be treated differently, specially. Whereas different types of benefits, the PFD program faced this challenge in three different cases, and the Alaska Supreme Court said that the PFD program has sort of three principal purposes. One is to distribute the state's oil and gas wealth to Alaskans. The other is to reduce population turnover. And the third is to encourage us as permanent residents to have an incentive or an interest in how our resources are distributed or utilized. So this resource rebate program is more akin to the PFD program because, as we know, our PFD is based on the last 5 years, the last five fiscal years. But we've noticed a sharp increase in the price of oil, but that five-year lag time sort of creates a hiccup where the state's coffers are filling up while the PFDs are sort of staying stagnant because of that five-year lag time. I think this interim resource rebate is a chance to address that hiccup and allow for money to be put back to the PFD residents through a resource rebate to address or acknowledge that there's a five-year lag time, but we wish to share that state oil wealth. So it's not energy relief, it's a resource rebate. And as a resource rebate, much like the PFD program, it is different. It's not a needs-based. It doesn't look at your or our need. It looks at saying Alaska permanent residents are entitled to a PFD because of those three purposes, and that because it achieves those three purposes, we don't have to have those very short or limited durational residency requirements that the basic necessity of life require.
Thank you. Representative Ledoux.
Is somebody who is in an institution eligible to receive this energy rebate?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes. There's two issues that would, if they had a legal guardian or somebody that was deemed to be their legal representative, they would file on their behalf. If they still had their legal authorities, they would be able to apply on their own behalf.
Follow up?
Please.
Does this include a penal institution? I'm not seeing any exception for somebody who's incarcerated.
Maybe through the chair, Representative Ledoux, there is a provision in here. If you give me 1 second, I'll put my finger on it.
And while you're looking, we are having people having difficulty hearing, so I know that it's not comfortable. I'm trying to give physical messages, but you need to talk closer into the mic and a little bit louder if you could.
How about I lean forward? Does that work?
That's absolutely wonderful.
We're on page 2, line 25 and 26. A person, the individual, is not eligible for a permanent fund. I'm sorry. I pointed my finger to the wrong provision. There is, since I had a hand in drafting this, there is a provision in here that says that if you're deemed ineligible for a permanent fund dividend based on a conviction, and that there's three different types. There's a felony conviction, there's a felony conviction tied to jail time, and there's what we call two-time misdemeanor convictions. Those three categories of convicted defendants would be ineligible for this resource rebate. And the language is in there. I helped draft it. I just can't put my finger on it.
Representative Ledoux, if we could pass on, and then maybe you could find that citation to so that we could cite it publicly on the record.
Would that That's be fine with me.
Any other follow-up question?
Not on this particular topic.
I actually am through my loop of who was waiting. Are there other questions from committee members? Representative Ledoux.
I'm just wondering about the provision which provides for a physical address. If you're applying not because you've gotten a permanent fund dividend, but you're in that other category. And what I'm worried about is in a number of the rural areas, people don't actually have, I mean, they have physical addresses, but these physical addresses aren't printed anyplace.
For those of you following with the legislation, that's on page 3, line 8, must show a physical resident address.
Thank you. So I'm kind of wondering how one could deal with that. I mean, because I represent a number of villages, and even when people apply for their their voter registration. I mean, they'll just list Old Harbor or Igiagig or Kakanak or something like that. There actually is not a street address that they have.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it's a good question. As you can see, subsection G on page 3, lines 6 through 18, we drafted into this 7 different ways to provide some proof of residence in Alaska, the goal obviously being to avoid somebody who simply has a P.O. box in Alaska. So we put in as many different types of indicators that would show residence in Alaska that we could, and I believe that the voter registration card alone would suffice. And if there are other suggestions, we could certainly add more, and it sounds like you may have a suggestion or a follow-up.
Well, I'm not sure I have a suggestion right now. I'll try to think about something. But Section G lists all of these things, utility, mortgage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then it says that for each one of these things that the physical address has to be listed. So I'm just wondering whether or not you could put in maybe a Section 8 or other substantial proof of physical presence, something like that. I'm not tied to that, but some catch-all.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, maybe simply removing the word physical and just putting residence address would alleviate that concern.
It might.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. If the Department of Law would follow up and see if there's any negative consequences, again, we don't want to move on the fly for amendments or something, but if you would think about that for a little bit. Following on those thoughts of Representative Ledoux, if you move down to on the same page to line 15, a paycheck stub really doesn't establish any kind of a residency. And so I had an email come in asking about seasonal workers coming in and somehow only being here for a summer season, but somehow being able to create a bureaucracy where the 6 months are hard to define. And so it appears the intent of this legislation is if a seasonal worker is here under the time frame and leaving, that they are going to qualify.
Madam Chair, I think if I'm looking at the three criteria, number 3 on page 3, line 5, that individual in applying, in addition to having to be present from April to October, and on the date of application, which is October 1 to November, they would also have to indicate, under the penalty of perjury, that they intend to maintain a home in the state. So much like you and I when we apply for the permanent fund dividend, they have to essentially affirm that they intend to remain. So if they're willing to commit that fraud, and there are criminal penalties as well as a provision in here that allows Department of Law to go after these folks if they do that, if they're willing to commit that type of fraud, then they may actually skate through the system. However, they would have to be willing to essentially commit a crime, unsworn falsification, and if they received that check, they would have stolen money from the state.
Representative Cisna.
Madam Chair, thank you. And my question is really, it just came, the whole discussion that has been had in Department of Health and Social Services because of the survey that they completed a year ago and are analyzing now on the uninsured, which probably if you're talking about an emergency payment to try to help people survive, that group is probably one of the most needy groups, the uninsured. And what they found was that Alaska is unique in that we have a huge population of people who do have seasonal work and live in an itinerant lifestyle. And it makes me wonder several things in that kind of discussion, in that this state is unique. It does have a different kind of population. And I am wondering right this minute if in that particular survey, which was, I think, different than a lot of the surveys we've had in trying to find out who the people are who really are up against it in trying to get resources to survive in Alaska, if there's not a hole maybe what we're doing to identify, for instance, the people who don't have addresses. And I lived in Kodiak in a situation where there was no physical address because it was a fish camp site. So those kinds of things can happen in Alaska. I also wonder, and I don't have a legal background, so I don't know, but if we're looking at the difference between a resource rebate and one that's based on a crisis rebate, if there's not, kind of what are the differences according to your department between those two, and why? And then the department, the question to the Department of Administration revenue would be why we switched from one to the other. First, I thought it was thinking of this as an emergency, and then if we're talking about resource rebate, that's very different than that. And what implications are there to that change? And should we be thinking about that?
Madam Chair, through the Chair, Representative Cisno, there was multi-parts to that. The categories, you're right, there may be a group of Alaskans that spend half a year here and half a year elsewhere. But as I indicated early on, our PFD program, as long as they're here for 185 days, and in Alaska is their home, they qualify for that permanent fund dividend, and this has a 180-day residence requirement. So if they live here for 180 days and they call Alaska their home and they have all the appendages of Alaska being their home property or get a paycheck through an Alaskan employer or a voter registration card, they would qualify for this resource rebate just as a permanent fund dividend applicant would qualify for the PFD. But your question seems to be indicating if the resource rebate is having the unintended consequence of leaving folks who have a need but don't meet the criteria, they're left without this dividend. That's a policy call for you folks to make. If this is energy relief, it would be drafted differently because relief, as we said, is focused on a person's basic necessities, food, shelter, and those sorts of things. But that would have to be a legislative decision that all Alaskans actually need that relief. And if we do all need that relief and that's what you want to pursue is energy relief, then we would probably have to draft this stuff differently. But I understood from the administration's position that this was a resource rebate, much like the PFD, but it acknowledged that the state oil prices is resulting in the state coffers filling up while our PFD is staying the same rate. And this is a way to sort of, on a short-term basis, offer a resource rebate to Alaskans, not based on need and not necessarily designed to catch that concern that you have. So I think what you have is a policy concern that I can't really answer for you. I think it would be better for the Department of Revenue or the administration to answer that.
Representative Sisna, if I could follow up, then it goes back to the question that I asked before. Why would we spend $500,000 to distribute it 30 days early when we have a system in place that could handle a distribution of a check for a resource rebate? If, in fact, the administration is saying that it's different because we have a blip in a five-year average and excess money coming in, why are we creating a whole separate department that sets up a separate bureaucracy to handle a one-time rebate? It seems inefficient.
Madam Chair, I can only attempt to answer some of the legal implications of what you're referring to. When we all applied for our 2008 permanent fund dividend, we all thought we were going to be applying for a certain benefit. And if we midstream as the legislature change that benefit, don't we then have to reopen the application process or redetermine eligibility? Don't we have to start anew because we have changed what's at stake for the applicant? We've changed what they're applying for. They're now applying for, let's call it, a super dividend. And so the due process interests do change. And then maybe we would have to tie this to the 2009 dividend. I think there are ways to do what you're referring to, but I don't know that there's a way to do it and tie it to the 2008 PFD eligibility without sort of reworking and rehaving another application process that deals with this again and opens up to those folks who may not have applied for simply the PFD but may apply for the super PFD or may fight a little harder when the department determines them ineligible. It definitely changes the field and would definitely change the process, and so we would have to rethink this. And I think this is sort of a middle solution that sort of addresses both of those concerns, that those that are deemed eligible for the 2008 dividend are built into this, but then we have a supplemental application process to catch those folks that fall through the cracks.
Well, again, I'm not an attorney, but I'm going to pretend to be one. So so you've asked. I think that your argument, you convinced me, who's not an attorney, but just playing one. So I'm going to push back. One of the original conversations that I had with another member of our body, and I've disclosed that, Representative Holmes and I off net have been looking at just, you know, in a cursory review, looked at the eligibility requirements, and her being an attorney, she's been satisfied. But the point was, under a rebate program, then, has not the courts decided that a shorter period of time than even the 6 months, I mean, now we're really running around the wagon, that 6 months has been challenged in the court as far as a rebate program that the administration is proposing now, and that we could, in fact, be challenged because we don't have a short enough time period. And I'm really not trying to go around the wagon, but when we first started about energy rebates, then that was one set of issues that we're asking the question for, that you'd want a longer time period, or at least most Alaskans believe that the court has said that the permanent fund requirements at a year physical residency can meet that muster. Now we're moving the other direction and saying, no, it's a resource rebate. Well, under a rebate program, then, have we gotten too long of a time period? And I'm not advocating for a longer one. I'm playing an attorney here, saying, are we not supposed to have a shorter time period in what I know about what the courts have done?
Madam Chair, there's sort of a couple parts to your question. The first one is, could we be challenged? Of course, there are plaintiff's attorneys out there who can put together class actions all the time. We've started to see those in the PFD world. So yes, we could face a challenge. But the PFD program through the Alaska Supreme Court has so far survived all of those challenges. And it is said repeatedly that this is something that is different. Well, let me back up. I think the concern that you're referencing comes from a United States Supreme Court decision, Sands v. Roe. And it is marks a change for the United States Supreme Court in how they've dealt with durational residence requirements. It used to be under the old system, and if you look at all the cases, they don't necessarily make sense. It seems that the court was just reacting to the facts before them and making decisions that made sense to them. But the old test used to be whether or not what we were doing in conditioning a benefit on a certain period of residency penalized or burdened the right to travel. And the focus was always, it seemed to be, what is the benefit that's being handed out? And if that benefit is a basic necessity of life, the court has said, you pretty darn well sure have a short durational residency requirement because those are important interests that residents need to get. However, the court has routinely acknowledged in footnotes and in dicta that holding doesn't apply to other types of benefits. And there's a category that was referenced in Sands that said, we don't, at this occasion, rule on whether or not our decision applies to portable benefits. And the Alaska Supreme Court, in dicta and a footnote in the Shikora case, said, it was a post-Sands case, said, although Mr. Shikora didn't raise this argument, we think the PFD qualifies as a portable benefit. And what a portable benefit is it's much like, I think the classic example is in-state college tuition. If I go out of state and qualify for in-state tuition and then come back to Alaska and utilize my education here, I've gotten a benefit from the state of California, for say, but I've utilized the benefit here in Alaska. So the Alaska Supreme Court has seemed to acknowledge that the permanent fund dividend, at least in Shikora, is a cash portable benefit that a person could move here, live for the requisite time period, and take it home to their home state and consume that benefit. And as a result, it's my opinion that Sands ruling that you're referencing, we qualify for that exception. And if someone takes us to the U.S. Supreme Court, much like if they brought the PFD to the U.S. Supreme Court, we would defend this on that exception.
Representative Salmon, followed by Representative Ledoux.
Yes. Under page 2, line 27, I think Representative Ledoux already brought up the physical address, which was a good point for the rural areas. And the other slight heartburn I have is the telephone number.
Representative Salmon, I don't think that the recorder could hear your question. Could you speak closer to the mic?
Okay, you want me to start over?
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Okay, under page 2, line 27, the physical address that I mentioned, Representative Ledoux already mentioned, which I have, you know, a little problem with, and the telephone number. Could you explain why the telephone number would be in there? I just don't quite get that.
through the chair, Representative Salmon, you're referring to the verifier requirement. We probably all recall there was a time period when we applied for our permanent fund dividends. We had to put verifiers in a desire to come up with easy, administratively practicable measures to implement to verify residency. We put the verifiers in this bill. So if it's such that person's telephone number is a good way for the department to contact that person and say, hey, did you verify that so-and-so was in Alaska? If people do not have telephone numbers, I'm sure we could draft this such that would be an alternate or an optional piece of information to provide. I would also think that if the Department of Revenue administering this had a way to contact that person, that's the heart of what this is after. If they decided that they were concerned with this particular applicant and wanted to verify that the verifiers had actually verified this person's residency, that they'd have a way to reach them. So I think we could probably draft this such that telephone number wasn't a required piece of information. And I should point out, there is an appeals process here, and a lot of these issues would probably get ferreted out or worked out in the appeals process. I think it is the goal to get this resource rebate back to Alaskans, and I don't know that, well, I guess it's implied that they could appeal that issue.
Good question, Representative Salmon. Representative Ledoux, followed by Representative Newman.
Going back to your response to Representative Fairclough's questioning about the durational residency requirement, I think what I'm hearing is that this is a lot more likely to pass constitutional muster, since it's given out to everybody, regardless of need, than it would be if you made it a needs-based program. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the answer is slightly more complicated than that, but in essence, you're correct.
And
Representative Ledoux.
Can we go back to my question about the incarceration? Would that be AS 4323005D? Does that specifically exempt people who are in penal institutions?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, you're correct, and we're referencing page 2, lines 25 through 26. I started reciting them, and then they seemed to read wrong to me, and I stopped, but that is the language.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for that follow-up. Representative Ledoux.
And then I've just have one more question. So if somebody isn't eligible, because I understand that they wouldn't be eligible if they were in jail, because there's a specific exception for that. What if they are simply in another institution? What would be the rationale for letting somebody collect their energy rebate if they're not in a position that they'd be spending, that they're impacted by this?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the resource rebate, much like the permanent fund dividend, goes to those folks as it is, and this is akin to the PFD program. So if it were, to answer your question, if this were energy relief, and folks weren't having energy needs, we would probably want to draft it to rule out those individuals from receiving it if there was a way to do so that it was administratively practicable.
Understand. Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to form a question here. And it has to do with trying to not have to go back and reinvent the wheel. And some of the things that you referenced was this is a type of a super dividend, and it's kind of my concern is, again, having the state have to pay another $500,000 plus to administer this, and the reason that this couldn't be folded into the permanent fund dividend was because it was separate. This was similar. You used the term of disaster relief for Hurricane Katrina. Did you go back and base any of this stuff on law that was done or looked at during Hurricane Katrina or anything like that? Because it's nice for, I know myself and other legislators, to compare things because we have nothing to compare this to. So did you go back? Did you work on any of that? Or is this all new language that you came up with? Again, because I'm really stuck on the fact that, you know, this is going to cost another $500,000 and why we can't maybe fold that in.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, it wasn't Mike Ford helped, played a lion's share of the role on the drafting. with myself and others at Department of Law, it wasn't based on a Hurricane Katrina program. It was based on essentially the Permanent Fund Dividend Program and other state programs that offer rebates or benefits. So the language is essentially created for this need, for this issue.
So we basically took the same outlines as the Permanent Fund Dividend, use that as a basic
framework, yes.
Framework, and then went off of that. Okay, then we'll work on that one. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you very much. And I want to return to Representative Salmon's question about the telephone, and I'm going to go back to the survey also on the uninsured. And Representative Salmon is the person at this table that represents rural Alaska, very rural Alaska, remote Alaska. And that is the part of the state that actually urban Alaska has a lot of uninsured. It's absolutely true. And increases in prices are going to probably affect those people pretty critically. But in rural Alaska, it's that many more times difficult for folks. And phones are that much rarer outside of our urban areas. If, in fact, this is an addition to the permanent fund rebate that we, not rebate, but the dividend we get, then it doesn't have that sense of urgency. It doesn't look like it's really addressing what I've been seeing in my visits to rural Alaska in the last few years. It's become more and more really critical that we start looking at what's happening in rural Alaska. But that's not going to be looking at a dividend. That's going to be looking at an energy rebate or a living rebate kind of thing. So I'm beginning to have kind of questions about what are we doing here? And wondering if we shouldn't really be talking more about the definition of what we're doing, because we're kind of sliding in between these two things. It's been mentioned both ways. Started with the energy, now it's on the resource. And I really would like to get down to what are we trying, who are we trying to help here, and why?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, I'm on the hot seat, but your question, really, I didn't hear a legal component to it, so I'd prefer to defer it to the administration.
You're right. Okay.
Actually, I appreciate that. Thank you for joining us. We would appreciate on the incarceration, you've pointed to the incarceration, but we talked about finding a middle ground for remote and rural Alaska on the telephone issue and the physical address, and so we hope to hear back from you on that. We have not moved any bills in front of us today in the thought that possibly conversations and questions might generate a CS from the administration if anything could be folded in. Representative Ledoux.
Well, I just have one more question for Chris. If you wanted to totally fold it in to the permanent fund dividend program so as to avoid the $500,000 fiscal note, but you were concerned with maybe some of the constitutional implications about that, that it's now going to provide the super dividend. Could you simply send out a notice to people that they have, if they were eligible for the permanent fund dividend but they didn't apply for it, they have, oh, six more weeks or a month or something like that to apply for it, and then make the requirements exactly identical? Would that avoid any constitutional or legal difficulties?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, there's two parts to that. One, I think there probably is a way to renotice the 2008 dividend such that we could eliminate or deal pretty properly with the due process concerns that I have. However, as Representative Fairclough pointed out, there are some concerns about constitutionality, and she has mentioned a concern about a challenge to the resource rebate program. If we make this a PFD program, it will be a challenge to the PFD program. So I'd encourage you to think about that as we move forward on resource rebate.
Representative Ledoux.
I guess I'm not quite following that. Why, if you made it with the qualifications exactly identical, why you'd end up with the challenge, whereas the PFD program has managed to successfully avoid challenges?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, you're correct. Practically speaking, there should be no difference. So you've said two things. If it's an identical but separate programs, there wouldn't be a concern. But if you're merging the two programs, then we have an attack on our permanent fund program instead of an attack on our resource rebate program.
But in your view, would the attack be any more likely to be successful than any of the other attacks? I mean, that's pretty well withstood constitutional challenge.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, you're correct. It just would be, we'd be just defending the permanent fund dividend program instead of the resource rebate program. That's the only distinction.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to acknowledge for the record that Representative Johansson is with us in the audience now also. Thank you for joining us this morning. Jerry, I still haven't heard, and Representative Cisna alluded to this, the issue of Alaskans started hearing the call for energy and energy relief. And so I really would like an administrative response to that. And then to give you time so that it's not a gotcha question, along Representative Ledoux's line of questioning on the PFD, is the administration in favor of the POMV that died years ago as far as a discussion in regards to the bleep in the screen of if we had excess revenue and we weren't on a five-year roll, but the 5% payout method, would have that solved the problem? Is that what we're doing in this resource rebate, sort of backdooring a POMV? And I'm not talking about government spending money. I'm talking about adding funds that have come in and made a high year, which was part of the Department of Law's conversation, that we have a big year that we're seeing a return on our investments differently than that five-year average, and so we're sort of kicking up the permanent fund. So I'll give you some time to think about that one and talk to us about the difference between an energy rebate and the resource rebate that's been presented to this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The key distinction I think to make is between the foundation for the payment and the reality or the circumstances that Alaskans are facing with high prices and energy prices. The foundation for the payment is a sharing of the state's resource wealth on an equal basis, and that's a concept that's enshrined in our Constitution, really in Article 8, that the people are the true owners of the state's resources. So you have to, in thinking about it, I think you have to separate out the foundation for the payment, which is sharing the state's resource wealth, and the circumstances that Alaskans are facing. When you really think about it, it's not surprising that we face high energy prices at the same time we have excess revenue to share with Alaskans. The two track along as the price of oil increases. But the distinction, and it's an important one, is that the basis for the payment is a equal distribution of excess wealth. It shouldn't be surprising that that happens or could happen to occur when Alaskans are also facing a lot of energy issues, as it's the price of oil is a common factor to both.
One of the challenges that Representative Cisna and Representative Salmon bring up, as well as Representative Ledoux, is that throughout the different regions in Alaska, people, citizens of the United States, constituents of Alaska, are facing different needs on energy. And we know that the administration is actively in search or working towards an energy plan that addresses those needs. And so when I was called into special session for this particular issue, that's at the heart of what I'm trying to look at, how we solve that, how we react to that in the best way for Alaska and not moving too quickly. So
Mike Mitchell calling back for help. I have a dying cell phone, so I'm at a pay phone now, so I'm just going to stay on this phone. Thanks.
Mr. Mitchell, you're live, just so that you know. So apologize for the interruption off net. To those of you at home, we went silent so that if there was a question coming in from off net that we were supposed to receive. So if you could just speak to that issue.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Can you repeat the question? I got off track a little bit.
We'll pass. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the willingness of the administration to look at the issue that we've discussed earlier pertaining to garnishment and your willingness to consider maybe some different possible aspects of that in a CS. I really do appreciate your willingness on that. And I also share some concerns that have been brought up about the cost of distribution of the check. So maybe there's some more creative ways we can look at lowering that cost. And so I trust that you're going to continue working on that.
Specific on my question was, rural Alaska and remote Alaska face different energy needs than urban Alaska. All of us are suffering when we pull up to the gas pumps or we use energy in the state of Alaska. My point is that rural Alaska and remote Alaska have different, more immediate energy needs, and sometimes when we look at a specific insight of education, we have district cost factors. And I know the administration, through their energy team, is looking at quantifying what that might look like compared if Anchorage, which tends to be used as the zero base for growth in energy uses, and then we look at how that affects in other smaller communities, how much more they have to pay. So that's my point. In an even distribution, I understand why it's easier, more effective and quicker to move under a resource rebate program that generally spreads everything flat to everyone, but that is not how the need is happening in the state of Alaska. The need is not a flat need. Remote and rural Alaska have higher prices already than we do, and so they are being disproportionately hurt. And that's not to say that urban doesn't need relief too, but if we're passing around $10, do we address the energy component factor that's different, or I understand that the administration is choosing a flat distribution, which is less likely to be legally challenged. So that's where I was getting to. The cost of energy is different in different regions around the state.
To the chair, you're correct. It is different and widely different on some occasions, but there are also a number of programs that are available, different programs that have been in place for years, like LIHEAP, various programs that are also available to residents of those communities. So I guess this is a single piece of, or single tool in the toolbox. It is a tool that is designed to be distributed on an equal basis. I think that's very important. And we do certainly understand that if you're talking about need, that fuel prices are higher in rural areas and significantly higher, but that's not the foundation of this payment is an equal resource rebate. And we hope residents of those areas would avail themselves of LIHEAP, of any programs, weatherization, rebates, anything available.
Respectfully, I accept that. But I thought that I was here to address energy needs. And one of those energy needs that's not in front of this committee is looking at alternative energy and long-term ways to use and invest Alaska's resources to benefit in perpetuity Alaskans who will continue to suffer. And so while the $1,200 may affect a family very positively today in being able to address some of those needs, how are we looking to the future if we're going to look at a $1 billion investment? And that's what I'm struggling with. I understand and accept we have money right now at this point of time that is greater than we anticipated. And I truly am battling with returning those resources into the pockets of the working men and women and the families in Alaska, but understanding that we have this enormous energy need that truly is an energy need that's going to be long-term, and how we use that resource that's coming in today so that it benefits us long-term. And so that's the balance that I'm trying to wrestle with right now along Representative Cisna of why are we here? Is it energy or is it a super permanent fund dividend? Representative Cisna.
Adding on to your comment, Madam Chair. I was aware that there was a severe energy need before I came to the regular session. And we were having to deal in the regular session with the fact that we had so much money. And there is a real, there's a very sharp, to me, divide between what is really going on in Alaska and this building. And that I understand, and I'm saying this not, I'm trying not to be adversarial, but it just is really very upsetting to have a feeling that we have enough money to actually do some really critical things that could long-term help Alaska and really get people out of the situation that we're in the middle of July right now. There's limited amounts of money to deal with the problem that's going to come very quickly in just not too many months from now in remote and rural Alaska. And I am looking at two bills here, which I understand are a part of a solution, but we've just had the answer that this is just part of the solution, and so it's some other program that you apply for. And the application alone, people's phones are being disconnected right about now in many places because of a lack of money. And that's just the start of where the trouble is. So we need to figure out what we're going to do, it seems to me, with this money we have, and are we just going to evenly share it with people, whether or not they're in a disastrous place, or are we going to do exactly what I see happening, and that is we either decide to make sure that that rural, remote Alaska survives so that they can continue spending money in our urban centers, or do we delay it? Can we somewhere here, right this second, hear if there's going to be an overall look at the package that the administration is working on so that we know where those pieces are and we can very efficiently address it as a legislature and get the things figured out in a way that really we can work as partners with you to get the answers? Is it this legislation? Which committee is it in, and how do we do this?
To the chair, Representative Cisna, it is just a piece of a much larger puzzle. It's an important piece, and I think Alaskans need it and should have it. It may be a good time, Madam Chair, to turn to the appropriations bill, which has other implications for energy. If you're looking for answers beyond this bill, there are pieces in that bill as well. That are important to rural areas, PCE appropriations, other things. If you're interested in more than just this bill, there are other pieces in that bill, and there are, you know, I mean, this bill doesn't halt or stop any progress that the administration is working on towards long-term solutions, towards mid-term solutions, towards other short-term solutions like the motor fuel tax. This is just one piece. It's not intended to be a comprehensive answer to all the problems. It's simply one piece of the puzzle that shares wealth with Alaskans on an equal basis as they own the resources on an equal basis. But it's not intended to be a solve-all or fix-all. It's just one part of the puzzle. There are other pieces in the appropriations bill, and there are other pieces that work is ongoing on.
Randy, for the record, could you state on this particular bill the fiscal note? This piece of the puzzle?
If you'd like, I could. For the record, Jerry Burnett again, Department of Revenue. The fiscal note for House Bill 4002 from the Department of Revenue is $800 million, of which approximately $800,000 is to operate the program, $520,000 to send out the checks, and about $300,000 to manage the supplemental application process. And then there's an additional $10,600,000 for the Department of Health and Social Services for Hold Harmless. So you're talking a total of about $810 million.
So just under $1 billion.
Yes, yeah, it's about a bit under $1 billion.
So what I found trying to do the state's business over the last 2 years is as money is rolling in, we start moving it much more quickly in much larger sums, and that millions become billions quickly, and that we sometimes lose sight of what that money really could do if it's invested in projects.
Representative Faircloth, just to put this in perspective to the revenue stream that we're receiving at this point, I think I sent to the committee, to your office and to Representative Ledoux's office, an estimate of revenues at various prices. And this morning, revenue oil prices were around 145, and they've averaged $138 a barrel for this fiscal year so far. And at those prices, we're looking at total revenues, if it continued through the year, in the $15 to $18 billion range. So,
Cherry, and how many days are we into this fiscal year?
We are a few.
Thank you. I'm just saying that is a little bit misleading the public. Not to say that we're not all experiencing $145
yes.
per barrel, but what's the current average would be more, what are we basing our current projections of revenue on price per barrel of oil?
Well, Representative Faircloth, when the revenue forecast was done in April, it was done at $82 a barrel. And clearly that's out of the realm of reality at this point. And so the first quarter, we actually, June revenues are in the fiscal year 2009. So we do have a month and a half of this fiscal year behind us. The first quarter of this fiscal year, we're certain that there's enough additional revenue beyond what was expected to fund all of the appropriation bills that were put in this special session.
Sir, I do not quibble with that at all, that we have the money to distribute it, but to leave the public with a thought that we have 10 extra billion dollars, that may be true going forward, but we're not basing our estimates on
right.
that particular number. So I don't mean that disrespectfully. It's an exaggeration. It's a number that we're all experiencing right now.
Right.
Are there any other questions from committee members to pose with the administration? The only other thought that I hadn't seen, the governor in press releases that I've seen has indicated that if the legislature doesn't like this, we should step up and provide something of relief for Alaskans. And so I was wondering if there is a source out there specific to remote Alaska and the villages and cities that live along a river system. Do we have a fuel loan program for zero base costs so that we can get those barges moving with fuel in them right now, so that we know that rural communities can be addressed? Or has that been a consideration at all, to be able to provide that energy relief now while the tides and the ice are still clear to get that through? And again, I'm just not wanting to knee-jerk reaction $1 billion. Is there something that we can put in place that can make sure that those individuals with truly crisis energy needs have an access to provide that so that those barges can start moving?
To the chair, I'm honestly not very knowledgeable in that area. Ms. Fisher Goad is here. She probably has more information than I do.
Your name for the record. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Sarah Fisher Goad. I'm Deputy Director of Operations for the Alaska Energy Authority. There are two loan programs that offer capital funds for purchasing long-term fuel. One is the Bridge Loan Program, which is run by the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, and the longstanding AEA program, which is the Bulk Fuel Revolving Loan Fund Program. We're in the midst of the kind of the application season for the fall fuel purchases. Right now, we at this point are not seeing a an additional need for additional funds for the bulk fuel revolving loan fund. The legislature passed House Bill 338 this last year that did codify the bridge loan program for commerce and also allowed AEA to borrow funds from the Power Project Fund for bulk fuel revolving loan fund needs. So at this point, there is a cap on those programs of $500,000 per loan. We are seeing a few applications at the $500,000 level, but not it's a handful of applications. It is a little early in the season to kind of know what that demand will be, but we think with the implementation of House Bill 338 and with our existing funds that the loan purchases for the eligible bulk fuel, the communities that typically borrow from bulk fuel will have their needs be met through that program.
Any questions from committee members? Is there any benefit that you see right now in offering that to individual versus bulk to somehow condominiumize the process? So if truly the issue for energy in rural Alaska is getting the barges moving now, is there a way that we can consolidate orders, or do they just buy from bulk fuel?
It's typically typically a community purchases and has the fuel delivered for the entire community, which includes retail purchases. So there typically is fuel being brought in that is sold for individual uses. So I'm not certain. I'd have to think about how or what type of capital would be needed or is desired for individuals. I haven't heard of that need. AEA typically doesn't deal with individual borrowers. Oftentimes we're dealing with the community borrower, the electric utility, or the village corporation.
So Representative Sisson's in line, but if you could think about it and maybe answer us in Anchorage when we're in Anchorage or at our next meeting, is there any way that we can estimate, or maybe we need to hear from Steve Hagenson? I think that might be, and the committee can let me know. Steve is the administration's point person on their energy policies and plans. And would a presentation from him be valuable to the committee first? So I hear that as a yes. If the administration could provide Steve to us either in Anchorage, we could probably accommodate, that's going to be difficult. It's going to have to be at our next hearing, probably here in Juneau, to hear from Steve. I'm just wanting to make sure that enough fuel is going to communities that could be landlocked before winter hits, and if there's a way that either Steve or you could let us know that issue, that would be helpful.
Madam Co-Chair, we are prepared. Steve Hagenson is on the schedule, I believe, for the 22nd to present AEA issues, and I believe at that point I think he's will be able to provide the committee with an update of where he is at with leading the long-term planning effort, and I think answering many of Representative Sisson's questions with respect to where we're at, what we're seeing, and the process. Steve's commitment to the legislature when he was first appointed in March was to provide his initial long-term plan in December. And he's been on the job since March. We've been a very, very busy agency with addressing the long-term planning efforts. It started with the town hall meetings throughout the state. He's working on now technical aspects with respect to what type of technology should be applied in areas. We are also working in addition and parallel to this, the implementation of the House Bill 152 program. We have announced with the Denali Commission the granting of $5 million of projects. We are preparing to go to LBNA to tap into to the Renewable Energy Fund for some additional projects that met the criteria for that RFP. In addition to that, we are working on the second RFP for additional projects to tap into the rest of that FY 2009 money that was made available by the legislature.
Representative Sisson, followed by Representative Ledoux.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question would be, I know that there was newspaper stories, and I think it was this previous year, where communities were, and it's been other times, where communities have received fuel from sources they could afford, but which were, I think, foreign sources, that we have had communities not getting fuel when they, and it was poor weather, as I recall. But at the same time, if there's enough funding, then you get usually the fuel that you need right before the end of good season for getting fuel, so that you've got enough for the whole time, for the whole winter. And I would like to have, when the report is given, maybe a little history in terms of what we've done in terms of the state monitoring the health of the energy situation in communities. What I know is in this community over time, we've seen some economic crises in communities, and I'd love to get an indication of exactly what's going on in our state right now in terms of economic health in our small communities. How many people have we lost? And the energy crises are going to cut down the size of our communities and possibly jeopardize their existence.
Thank you, Representative Cisner. Representative Ledoux.
Well, this is probably more in the way of a comment, but I really am interested in hearing from Steve Hagenson. I mean, I understand that when the patient is bleeding, that in addition to major surgery, that you need Band-Aids too, but we're talking about an almost billion-dollar Band-Aid here. So before we decide that that's the right thing to do, I'd like to see somebody talking about the long-term plans.
And thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I believe Steve will be prepared to answer those questions for the
committee. Sarah, we can't hear you. I don't know if you could speak just a little bit louder.
I believe that Steve will be able to answer the questions that the committee has with respect to the process with the long-term plan and addressing those issues.
Thank you.
With that, I know Representative Newman has a last question to follow up with Mr. Burnett. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Burnett, in the fiscal notes, we're looking at a statement that says we're going to have 45,000 additional persons that are going to be qualifying for this. We also have, that's on fiscal note number 3, the explanations, the analysis. But we've also have an analysis that says you're going to be able to accomplish all that work with 9 temporary staff. And you're going to be able to do that with a minimum amount of money. That seems to be somewhat almost lowballing it. That's a lot of work for 9 temporary people to do. Can you explain what processes they'd be going through, how they're going to be able to accomplish that task within somewhere of a month?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, those people will be accepting applications. They'll be imaged into the same system we use for the PFD. And then whether they determine qualifications will be determined, and they will then enter the information into the database so the checks can be driven from that. We base those numbers on the same productivity levels that we get from the seasonal employees we have in the Permanent Fund Dividend Division in terms of handling documents and handling input to the database. So I think it's a very reasonable estimate. It was done by the same people that do the budgets for the rest of the department, and it does not consider that these people will have an opportunity to be inefficient. I think that's correct. We do have, there's some possibility that it could be more work than we think it is, but we do applications every year. We've done applications every year since 1983, and I think we have a pretty good track record knowing how much work it is to do that type of thing. These will be a simplified application relative to a PFD application with more simple guidelines.
Madam Chair, if I may, I believe that the estimate that you're, just so that people know what we're talking about here, is on fiscal note number 3. The cost of administering the supplemental application process is estimated at $325,000. That's $325 for 9 employees to do this for 30 days, approximately 45,000 applicants.
To the Chair, Representative Newman, actually, they'll be here. That's a 60-day application period, and we actually have, if you look at the detail, and I have a detailed project breakdown, some of those people will be employed for 3 months. Some will be employed for the balance of the year because there will be some problems that come up, and people will have to be looking at this. You know, we would be expecting that there'd be people that would appeal, that would have problems, and so we've kept people on. We also expect that one of the people who was kept on for the balance of the fiscal year would be helping man the PFD fraud control line, because we would expect that there would be some calls generated to that as a result of this program. So we've considered those issues. And I think, as I said, I think we have a track record and have administered this program for a number of years.
Just a quick comment, Madam Chair. Mr. Burnett, we also have a track record of increasing the operating budget of 12% to 14% over the last few years, too. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Newman. I don't need this one answered right now, but I said I was getting emails in, and so if there are legislators, I haven't allowed those who have joined us here from other areas across Alaska, state representatives, if they have questions, if they could focus those through Representative Ledoux's office. She has staff here in Juneau, and I do not, though I am being assisted, thank you very much, from Representative Meyer's office. Suzanne Cunningham has been helping me. But if there are questions from other legislators, and you want Community and Regional Affairs to address those, if you could email to Representative Ledoux's office, we can take a look at those and try to bring those forward for you. One of the questions that I've received from the public was in regards to children, and it's multiple fold. One is that we will be the word catapult comes to mind, and then I've said something about you exaggerating, so I don't want to exaggerate and be the brunt of my own correction. So some children will be required now to file a greater tax return that can impact families in different ways. Specifically, if they don't have access to computers, there may be an additional burden to families for tax preparation on children that have been able to avoid that for so long. So that's one point. The second point is, what happens when parents don't apply for the rebate? Under the permanent fund guidelines, when we're using those particular ones, a child who reaches 18 whose parents have failed, as I understand it, to apply for their permanent funds can come back to the state and ask for those permanent funds within a period of time. Will the rebate program be shut off so that they can't do that, or will it be able to go forward? Will they be those children be able to collect? That's one question.
Okay, Representative Faircloth. In answer to your first question, the resource rebate would be fully taxable under federal law. So it would have tax consequences for families, for individuals. Of course, you know, having money that's taxed is better than having money, not having money for most people.
I just want families to be aware that yes, they will have a responsibility.
It is fully taxable to children. The other question, this is a one-time program with a sunset date, and so there would be no opportunity for a person who didn't apply or didn't receive it during this time to come back and apply later. So unlike under the permanent fund dividend program, where you have 2 years after your 18th birthday to come back and reapply and receive anything that your parents failed to apply for.
So our outreach needs to be fairly significant, because we need them to try to collect that now for
correct.
Those children.
That's correct. It's a one-time, one-chance program.
And then on your appeals process that could take more time, would we expect to see a supplemental request from the administration, or will we be able to handle both the bureaucracy or the administration of the program inside of our 2009 fiscal year? Have you contemplated that?
Representative Faircloth, as far as the ongoing costs, because as you probably know with PFD, and I know that's what you're concerned about, sometimes you have appeals that are going on a year or 2 years afterwards. What we would intend to do with this, I believe that the amount in the fiscal note, the $800 million, is sufficient to fund the program. And unless there's more people out there that we than we expect, and then we would be and the way the appropriation is written, it's the amount necessary for the $1,200, so it's adjustable internally the way the appropriation is written. But what we would do on June 30th next year is we would find out how many we're going to keep track of any that are in appeal. We'll know how many applications that could be paid, and we would encumber funds from this appropriation, which we could then use to pay, so that would not result in a supplemental as a result of an appeals process.
Thank you for that clarification. Again, if there are questions from other legislators or community members, if they send them either to Representative Ledoux's office or mine, we'll make sure that all the committee receives them. We did print everything that I had received in my office today for your review. For those listening at home and those here today, the next time that Community and Regional Affairs will hear from the public on this issue is in Anchorage next Thursday, July 17th, from 4 to 6 at the Anchorage LIO office. I'm really good at landmarks, so that's behind Orso's or Glacier Brew House in downtown Anchorage. So I'm sure I don't have the physical address listed here. So anyone who knows where the Anchorage LIO is, please come down. We'll be on the second floor in room 220, again from 4 to 6 p.m. to take public testimony at that time. Representative Cisna.
Madam Chair, I would like to ask if there's going to be any video teleconferencing.
My understanding is there will not be video, but there will be teleconferencing. So you can call in from across the state to that Anchorage. And if I could continue, I was going to announce our schedule again.
Okay.
Then on Tuesday, July 22nd, we will hear on both bills. The testimony will only be by invitation only. Well, one of those invited, obviously, is Steve, our energy lead, as well as the administration, to continue answering questions if we receive those over the course of the time. That meeting will be at 2 o'clock here at the Capitol in room 124, so that is not that's next Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, it is the co-chair's hope that if the questions are answered, that we take the public comment and are able to move that bill from committee at that point. So that's the intended schedule, and that's why we are meeting today, hoping to move this along quickly. Any questions from committee members on the schedule? If not, then I'd like to have the administration come forward and speak to the committee about HB 4003, which is another component. It is my intent to end the meeting at 10 o'clock unless we're in heated conversation, since we do have another opportunity for both the administration and the public to hear about this issue. But I'm willing to listen to committee members if they want to extend a bit beyond that. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Karen Rayfield, Director of OMB. Thank you for the opportunity. I think you have discussed briefly the elements of House Bill 4003, the appropriation for the resource rebate program. It includes several things. As Mr. Burnett pointed out to you, in addition to the resource rebate, $800 million, and the hold harmless, which is $10.7 million, there are some other items in the bill. We have requested your approval of $9.6 million for the power cost equalization program. That would include also a component in fiscal year 2008. $600,000 would be necessary to fully fund the PCE program in 2008, and then an additional $9 million, which is based on our best estimate at this time of the current program, looking at what has changed in oil prices for fiscal year 2009. Additionally, there is $150,000 requested in there, which is a shared tax hold harmless in the bill that's not before this committee, the suspension of the motor fuel tax. We have several communities with municipally owned airports. If we suspend the aviation fuel tax, this would hold them harmless for that loss of revenue. So it's a small component of that bill, but it is included in this appropriation bill that's before you. And Madam Chair, we could go through it section by section, or if there are detailed questions about PCE or the motor fuel tax, of course I can bring up Ms. Sarah Fisher Goad or Mr. Burnett also.
What's the will of the committee?
Madam Chair, I have some questions for Ms. Rayfield, and I don't know if it's easier for her just to take the questions or go through as we go through, or...
I've had one committee member request a sectional. Can the sectional be done briefly?
Absolutely.
If we could go through sectional, and then we'll take up questions, if that's all right with the committee. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I do feel like I'm leaning way over the table. First section, Section 1, A and B, is the appropriation request for the shortfall in fiscal year 2008 for the Power Cost Equalization Program. You can see that it's an increase of $600,000, and it just changes the existing appropriations to reflect those increases. Sections 1C through E, again, adjust the appropriation for fiscal year 09 based on what our current estimate is to fully fund PCE program in FY 2009. Section 2 of the bill is the appropriation of $800 million to the Department of Revenue for the Alaska Resource Rebate Program. It does include the administrative costs of approximately $800,000 that Mr. Burnett spoke to earlier, and the non-permanent positions to administer that program. Section 3 of the bill is the hold harmless provision under the Department of Health and Social Services. The estimated amount necessary is $10.7 million to continue eligibility for certain assistance programs as a result of receiving this resource rebate. There are administrative costs of about $770,000 and approximately 9 non-permanent positions to do that work. Section 4 of the bill, Madam Chair, is to the Department of Revenue, estimated $150,000, again, for the shared taxes, hold harmless as a result of suspending the aviation fuel tax. There are several communities that would receive funding under that appropriation: Anchorage, Juneau, Ketchikan Gateway Borough, Kenai, Kodiak, Palmer, Soldotna, and Wasilla. Section 5 of the bill provides a retroactive date for the appropriations requested in Section 1A and 1B for the PCE shortfall in fiscal year 2008. Section 6, subpart A, has the contingent language for Sections 2 and 3 of the bill having to do with the resource rebate program. 6B is contingency for passage of the bill suspending the motor fuel tax. And the final section of the bill, Madam Chair, is the immediate effective date.
Thank you. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have to almost take a deep breath on this one, because I'm, Ms. Rayfield, I asked for somewhat of a long-range plan. I asked this from Commissioner Galvin, too, when we were in Fairbanks. And we seem to be spending quite a few billions of dollars here. This is just short of $1 billion, what we're talking about here. We've heard about road work that we need to have done to get ready for a pipeline, several billion dollars. We've heard about workforce training programs that are going to be several billions of dollars. We need to do some mass transit programs in this state. We have increased operating budgets of 12 to 14%. You know, that it just seems to be ballooning up. We had some cap, you know, the spending of money on building our infrastructure is important to us, and I think that that's the important part of our capital budget process, because it comes right from the public. It comes right from the communities that we represent. A lot of those capital budget projects were vetoed this year because we were told we didn't have the money to do them. So I'm getting some mixed signals here. We're going to get rid of the motor fuel tax. But I want to know, and I'm very uncomfortable with the fact that we are now talking about giving away another $1 billion of what we heard earlier from Mr. Raro, that this is excess money or excess revenue. And we don't have excess revenue. We're going to be in a deficit in a few years. I want to know from you, where are we going on this? How many billions of dollars do we have on the table right now laid out to spend in this state to get ready for a pipeline? And then to say that we've got extra revenue to do this, to say that this is extra, I just can't get there, and I'm having a real problem with that.
Madam Chair, Representative Newman, I certainly appreciate your comments, and I think that all of us in this room share your feelings and your views about needing a long-range plan. I know this legislature and this administration are supportive of that. House Bill 125 that passed requires that we produce a long-range plan when we bring the budget to you this December. There are many things, as we all know, affecting Alaska in a way that we couldn't have predicted even 6 months ago where we are. We do know that we have significant infrastructure requirements with the gas line or even without the gas line. The state of Alaska has a huge need in deferred maintenance and infrastructure development across the state. A long-range plan is absolutely critical for us so that we know how best to invest those dollars. The governor has said from the beginning of her administration that we are going to be responsible. We're going to be reasonable in the proposals that we bring before the legislature. Her goals have been to control the growth of government and save for the future. That is exactly how we're going to be able to bridge the gap between now and the time that we see first gas and revenues from first gas. But that is going to take some significant discipline, even with some of the increases that we're seeing here. We have to be able to move forward, and we have to do it in a responsible way. We are working diligently to bring those plans to you. Mr. Haginson has hit the deck running on the energy plan. We want to make certain, working with the legislature, particularly on the areas of alternative and resource or renewable energy programs, that we invest wisely. We look at those projects that are going to have the best return for our investment. The governor's proposals here today was designed to be very short term, to do a rebate back to Alaskans based on the revenue that we have seen, knowing that with that increase in revenue to Alaska, we also have communities and individuals and families that are hurting because of these increased costs. It was not meant to be a long-term answer. This is a very short-term solution while we continue to move forward on these other components.
And just very briefly, Madam Chair, if I may, Ms. Rayfield, if we could get some type of an estimate on, again, I'm going to ask this one more time, on what we think we're going to get, what's on the table right now from transportation and social services. We've got people with no medical insurance in this state. I mean, we're in trouble. These people are desperately in trouble, whether they can pay their heating bills or not. They if they're not healthy, they can't survive either. But we've got a lot of things on this table that have been proposed by this administration and other legislators. What is those numbers? And I don't need exact numbers, but we're talking several billions of dollars. It's billions, B's, that keep coming to us. So maybe at the next meeting we could get some type of a guess on how much has been laid out this year, on how much we're going to be spending in the next few years, on how much of this extra money that people say we have, but I don't feel we have, because I think we need to be saving some of this money. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Newman, I think that the governor would very much agree with you. We do need to have a plan, and we are going to bring you one.
Thank you. For the record, Representative Olson was excused this morning, and he does have control in Labor and Commerce, the motor fuel tax. And I'll hold with that, but I'm wondering if committee members want an update. We could possibly have him present what's happening there or ask for ourselves at this committee. Representative Ledoux.
I've got a question about the power cost equalization aspect of this bill, and actually it goes just broader to power cost equalization. Could you explain to us what communities are eligible for power cost equalization? You don't need to necessarily identify the communities, but what are the criteria that are used for being eligible for power cost equalization?
Madam Chair, Co-Chair Ledoux, would you allow me to bring Ms. Fisher Goad up to the table? I think she could give you a much more concise answer.
Sure.
Thank you. For the record, again, I'm Sarah Fisher Goad, Deputy Director of Operations for the Alaska Energy Authority. Through the co-chair Representative Ledoux, the power cost equalization programs, eligible communities, there are approximately 180 in the state that are eligible, and it's based upon what the utility that served the community provided for the fuel that they used to generate electricity back in 1985 when the program was established, or excuse me, I think it's 1984. If they used at least 75% of diesel in 1984, that community is eligible. The communities that are not eligible are the Fort Ann Pool communities, the railboat communities, and any community that has a a rate for power less than the floor, which for this year is 12.83 cents.
Representative Ledoux.
Has there been any thought given to revisiting power cost equalization and making it basically a statewide program depending upon what the costs of energy are for the various communities?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I have not. The call has been expanded to address power cost equalization, but my understanding that was something requested from legislators to do that. The administration is not proposing changes to the power cost equalization program at this point, but I do know that there is a lot of interest with respect to the program. I have heard that there is some concern when you have a floor of 12.83 cents based upon the three largest communities or the three communities that there are other communities even with hydro. I think Kodiak is an example and Glen Allen is an example, and actually Fairbanks is an example of a community that has power costs greater than 12.83 cents right now.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm not sure how many more questions we're going to go on, but if you could pull the mic towards you when you speak, the recorders are having difficulty picking up for transcription. Other questions from committee members? So we will look to have some kind of conversation on the motor fuel tax. I certainly want to know as an individual legislator whether that affects our federal appropriation or not. And I understand that it does not directly, but it could in an indirect way. One other issue, and I don't know if Randy is still here. Some time ago, we adjusted the speed limit from 55 to 65, and I've got to say that I was one of those at a community council that actually was in the minority and voted no. As the state was taking comments on raising the speed limit to 65, and one of the reasons that I voted no in my community council was not in the legislature, nor I believe even on the assembly at that point, but just talking to my neighbors. And one of my concerns was I had young teenage boys who tend to put their foot fairly heavily on a gas pedal, stop fairly quickly in learning how to drive, and it just seemed a slower would be safer for my family. So it was a personal issue, and I lost that vote, and the speed limit went up to 65. So the question specific for the administration is, I am so proud to say that in looking at Juneau and the crisis that they faced, that they were able to actually look at conservation, and in a conservation in a big way, and that we did that at the state capitol. And if you were here with us today and not at home, your lights might not be on. So part of the capitol is now shut down and turned off. Our computers are shut down on a more frequent basis, and we are looking at ways as your legislature, as your state capitol, as your administration to conserve and use less. And so I'm wondering if we're looking at state policy right now as we're auditing an energy policy and looking forward to making plans. Some of the issues that I'm looking at are right now it's 65 on the highways and 55. I don't know, but I've been told anecdotally that saves gas. And that if we talk or had some kind of PSA announcement, and I really appreciate the governor and her family going forward with specific PSAs, but I know I have two teenage boys that still put the gas on fast and stick the brake on quick, and you know that talking to them as a parent about a steady stream that slowly escalates or accelerates and slowly decelerates is better than and will save money. So what are we doing at a state policy level inside of public safety? We idle vehicles. Are we not idling them anymore? Is there a safety practice that's still in this energy situation would have us doing the same things? Or since fuel prices are going up how they are we looking at how we consume energy first as a state, and then second, how are we expanding those policies out into our roadways and other places we use? Our ferry systems, is 22 knots the right speed? And please, if that's really fast, I don't know. I don't drive a boat. But, are we looking at those policies in state so that we start looking at our own energy consumption and then set that example and ask the public to follow?
To the chair, I can talk to a few specific items. I know what we're working on at the ferry system is some fuel monitoring computers that we hope will reduce energy fuel consumption by 15% to 20%. I think BC Ferries is already using those. We've got them in one boat. We're looking at putting them in two more. So we are, you know, within the portfolio that I work with, DOT and some of the other agencies, there are, you know, conservation efforts ongoing. But I think Mr. Hagenson would probably be the best to talk about them in a maybe a more comprehensive way.
The big one for me is 65 to 55. And originally when that tag was going, 55 saved lives. And so I was wondering if there was an increased safety component that happens from 55 to 65, or truly as those in that I was outvoted by at my community council that said getting to work on the Glen High was better at 65. And granted, I'll just raise my hand and I travel 65. I like that speed, though. In energy prices, I've tried to knock it down, but everybody just passes me by. So then I'm the slow boat on the Glen Highway, so I'm usually up running at 65 too. So is there database, scientific base that says 55 reduces consumption and does it save lives on our highway if we were at 55 instead of 65?
To the chair, it's an interesting question. I don't happen to know the answer myself, but I can check with the DOT safety and highway division and try to get some more information. I think Washington State might have, or certain counties in Washington State might have started going to a 55 speed limit.
Thank you so much. Karen, did you have?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say that we have been talking because of the Juneau experience here, and we saw some real savings in our state agencies and in the measures that they took. And as we're looking forward into our 09 fiscal year, we're asking departments to see what of those measures they could implement on an ongoing basis, because we did see savings here that we could continue, and I think it'll be very important for us to do that.
Representative Salmon?
Yes, that Fisher, I have a question on the page 2, line 6, section C. I think it's probably more like for, I understand where the section B under that section comes out is 9 million, but right on the bottom there, there's a power cost equalization endowment fund. Could you explain those three numbers there, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Salmon, on the in subsection C, I believe what you're seeing is the, in subsection B, what you're seeing is the $9 million going into the fund capitalization, the power cost equalization fund, and then in subpart D, you're seeing the increase in the appropriation to be able to expend the $9 million. But we can bring Fisher Goad back to the table.
I think that'll be, explaining the 16, the 18, and the 9 on subsection C or B. Yeah, B.
Madam Chair, Representative Salmon, yes, that's the component that is coming from the $16 million is the component that is coming from the generated from the Power Cost Equalization Fund, the endowment fund, and then it's further capitalized with state general funds. So we have to put the additional $9 million in general funds in order to be able to fully fund the program.
So what we're seeing inside the brackets is a deleted number?
Yes, it was a lower amount in the original bill, and we're adding the $9 million to that.
Follow-up, Representative Salmon?
Yes, so where this $350,800 goes, I mean, is that additional to the $9 million, or?
I'm sorry, could you please repeat the number that you're looking at?
We're saying $9 million is going into the PCE, right?
That would be correct.
Right there on subsection B. Then if you go down there, you see at $9,353,800. Where does that 353 go? That's what I want to know.
Madam Chair, Representative Salmon, it's just an increase to the original number was $9,353,000, and we've just added another $9 million to that number.
Okay.
So it's just the total now of general funds going to the power cost equalization program will be $18,353,800.
Yeah, that's what's so confusing about it, because you have two numbers and
Understand.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions from committee members? Again, I'm interested in PSAs on conservation and what individual families can do to help. Thank you so much for the administration and the presenters who've been here. Thank you for committee members and others from the legislature who've joined us this morning. For those of you at home, again, there's an opportunity in Anchorage this coming Thursday, actually, the 17th, the day after tomorrow, at the Anchorage LIO from 4 to 6 to comment on these two pieces of legislation. With that, we're adjourned.
Thank you.